Welcome to Let's Talk Memoir, a podcast for memoir lovers, readers, and writers. I'm your host, Ronit Plank. Today, my guest is Rona Maynard, who found happiness at 65, a story she tells in her new memoir, Starter Dog, My Path to Joy, Belonging, and Loving This World. She first broke into print at 14 with a short story about bullying and still receives fan mail from teens who are reading it in class. She worked in magazines and spent a decade at the helm of Chatelaine, Canada's leading magazine for women. Her editor's column garnered a loyal following, and when she disclosed a struggle with depression, she helped kickstart a national conversation about mental health. When Rona stepped away from corporate life, she had to learn to unwind. Her best teacher was a rescue mutt who had received his basic training in a prison. Welcome, Rona.
I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you so much for spending time with me today, and I'm so excited to talk about your new memoir, Starter Dog, and learn a little bit more about your time with Casey, who is pretty much the star of your memoir, along with you. So can you share a bit about your memoir for those who have not yet seen a copy?
Love makes you do the damnedest things, and this book is the story of one of them. I was in the dumps when my husband said, let's get a dog. I thought, what kind of cockamamie idea is this? If we were meant to have a dog, this would have happened when we were in our young years with a kid around to play fetch. I thought we should be hiking the Camino or something, not picking dog fur off the sofa. But I could tell that my husband really, really wanted this dog. And one thing I've learned in decades of marriage is that if your spouse feels ardently about something, you should give it your best shot. You should try and make it happen. So very grudgingly, I said, okay.
Mm-hmm. And it was, it's very interesting because you watch this whole situation unfold, and it is a surprising thing to first get a dog after you're totally empty nesters and enjoying your life traveling and being independent and kind of rediscovering what marriage between two is like without a family there. Do you think in hindsight that he knew that this would help you feel a little bit better?
Well, you know, in the back of his mind, I think perhaps he did. The history of our relationship is that he's always the one who says, let's do it. Going back to let's get married, I was like, oh, we've known each other 5 months. We're too young. We're only in school. I need to be jollied along. I need to be persuaded that something I kind of sort of want to do is going to work out. Mm-hmm. And he knows me so well. We have been together for so many years that I think he sometimes knows what I want before I do. And he had seen me struggling to figure out what I should do with the next chapter of my life. It had been years since I stepped down from my big job at the magazine, years since I wrote my first memoir. I was cracking my brain on this big, complicated conundrum, so I thought, of what'll my next project be? And I thought it was going to be something that I could control and manage. Mm. In his wisdom, my husband could tell that it was going to be a feeling. It was not going to be a plan. And dogs are very good at unlocking our innermost feelings.
Yes. And I should mention, I don't know if you know this, but I have three dogs myself. So you are talking to a dog lover, and I really do see how much being around them and allowing myself to relax even when I'm busy and spend time with them and check in, even that is so good for me. And even when my husband can't walk them and it's my turn and I really don't feel like doing it, I always feel better after I come home. It's just great, right? It's good on so many levels. I love that you said this wasn't going to be a plan. It was going to be a feeling. I think that's what you said. And I can imagine what that must have been like, waiting for the next inspiration to strike or to just get down to business, roll up your sleeves and work on a writing project, and feeling like I just don't know what I want to do and it's not really happening.
That's right. And writing for me is always associated with plans in the beginning. But writing comes from the heart. If you do not feel it in the core of your being, the reader isn't going to feel it either. It's got to be important to you before it matters to the reader.
Yes, I agree. And I also find it, I feel like if a writer has been working on a project for a while and it's not happening, it's not clicking, you don't feel excited about it or enlivened by it or curious about it, often that's enough to get us to stop writing and to not want to even continue. I mean, I think if you get far enough along into a project where you've had to push yourself in a way that doesn't feel inspired or exciting or good and centered, and you actually have an end product that people read, I think they would pick up on that. But usually, luckily, I think for a lot of writers, you sort of can follow your instincts and realize, you know, this is just not cooking.
Well, when you talk about cooking, things cooked on just about every dog walk. And that's really how this book began. I was cracked open by the experience of walking a dog, being with a dog in the world. Before I had a dog, I would just power along. Walking for me was either about exercise or it was about getting somewhere. Walking had to justify its existence. And suddenly, there I was with a male dog who had to pee and mark all the time. And that meant I had to slow down. Mm-hmm. And when he lifted his leg or he discovered a scent that fascinated him or a person who wanted to make friends, well, I had to stop. And I suddenly looked with fresh eyes at where I was and who I was with, human and not. And It was as if a paintbrush washed color over the world. I had been in these places many, many times before, but they were new. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of Emily Dickinson moments. I would watch a bee circumnavigating a coreopsis blossom. I watched two insects having a fight to the death. I watched a frog in my path, and that frog had found the only cool spot on a hot day. How did that happen? Mm-hmm. I became enthralled. The world revealed its wonders to me.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that this has something to do also with vulnerability?
With openness to the moment. Mm-hmm. With aliveness to the moment, letting the moment in and letting yourself respond to it. I'll give you an example. When I looked at the frog, I was transported back to the frog prince. This was the princess who thought the frog was ugly. And she kissed the frog, and he turned into the handsome prince. I remembered being in biology class and having to dissect a frog because our teacher told us that the frog's body is, at the most elemental level, kind of like our own. The frog is a vertebrate. The frog has lungs. If you really look at the innermost workings of a frog, you will think about the commonality between all living things. And separate things start to come together. I'm a very associative writer, and it excites me to no end when I look at one thing and I'm reminded of other things.
Mm-hmm. What about this memoir and this idea to write about Casey and you and your husband, Paul, when did you realize, I'm going to write about this?
I had been writing Facebook posts about little things that we saw on our walks. And they were very tiny stories in the beginning, probably only about 300 words or so. And because they gave me pleasure, I wrote more and more of them. And people started to say, Rona, don't you think you have a book here? Some of these people were other writers I respected. And if they thought there was a book in there, I came to conclude, well, they're probably right. And I actually thought, silly me, that this was going to be a simple book to write because it was going to be about joyful moments in an ordinary day, that, and I would just string them together. Mm-hmm. Well, I started getting down to the business of doing that, and I found it was anything but simple. Because I needed a narrative arc there. I needed a conflict, and I needed a progression, and I needed a connection between all these very small things. It's like having a bunch of beads, but where's the necklace? Mm. A bunch of tiles, but where's the mosaic?
Mm-hmm. I really like those analogies.
So I had heard the advice, and I'm sure your listeners have too, that when you don't know how things fit together, you should print them out and put them all in the floor. Put all your chapters on the floor and look at them. Margaret Renkel, whom I greatly admire, is one of the writers who have given that advice. Well, I would have needed a gymnasium to do that on my aching knees because there were just too many pieces. So here's what I did. First of all, I went more deeply into the moments that I loved the best. I took them off Facebook. I made Word documents of them. And I asked myself, where is the magic here? What was it about this moment that compelled me to write about it? Often I had taken a photo, by the way, and I used the photo to recapture the texture of that moment. And then when I had my many, many chapters, I eventually put them into a Scrivener document. And that helped me to work more efficiently than a Word document would ever have allowed. I love the binder feature in Scrivener. For the benefit of listeners who don't know about it, you look at the left-hand side of your document and you see a list of all your chapters. And you can move them around. You can change the order. You can create a space at the bottom where you put all the bits and pieces that you don't know what to do with. And you see what you've got in the treasure chest. You probably have an overabundance of riches, and some of them are not going to be as strong as others. One thing that I noticed is I had a lot of stories that were repetitive that made the same point. I had a lot of stories about encounters with very troubled people, a lot of them homeless. Well, I didn't need all those. And some of the ones that had seemed really important to me in the writing, I discarded because I didn't need them anymore.
Yeah, I love that you're talking about this because it is organizationally, it's a big question memoirists, people with memoirs in progress have is, how do I know what I need? How do I know where to put it? What is the structure? What is the arc? So this is really useful, especially this idea that you had in some sense redundancies, which of course you didn't because each piece of writing is different. But when you think about a story arc and where the narrative is going, you had to discern which you needed and which you didn't. And that's difficult. Did you find that you were able to do that pretty close to having produced those pages, or did you have to wait a while to be able to sort through what you wanted to keep and what you wanted to get rid of?
It was a very slow process. This book reads as if it just flowed, as if I just sat down and wrote it. And it gives me a great deal of pleasure that it does that. But it took about 5 years, I think, in the writing. And now that it's done, I can look at it and I can see that there is a progression in all these encounters that I have with people on the street. That in the beginning, I'm standing outside of their lives and they puzzle me. And then I get more and more involved in them and their dilemmas. There's a chapter in the book where I meet a homeless man who is trying to clean up his corner of my neighborhood on a very hot day. And he asks me if I will do one thing for him, if I will fill his water bottle. Now, I did not do that one thing that he asked, and I have regretted it ever since. Instead of filling his water bottle for him, I told him where he could fill it himself, because it was a hot day and I wanted to get Casey home. And in the moment, I didn't think I could spare 20 minutes to do this errand for Michael, the guy in the park. So that moment is a crisis for me. It is a clarifying moment in which I realize after the fact that I have not been kind. And not only that, I was never taught when I was growing up to be kind, because that's not what my parents valued. They valued achievement and winning writing contests and getting published at a very young age. So the next encounter, I think it's the next encounter, is with someone that I stand up to. I take a stand for kindness. I am on a streetcar and I see a Muslim woman being abused verbally by a white supremacist. And I tell him to stop, thinking that other people on the streetcar are going to back me up, which nobody does. Everybody else just sits there. And this is a moment in which I claim my power and I claim my responsibility. And I have to ask myself, well, why did I do it if nobody else backed me up? If I couldn't shut this fellow up? Well, I did it because I was setting an example. Maybe they're going to think about it later and realize, well, this is happening to me, going to happen to me again. I'm going to see somebody abused, and what am I going to do? Am I just going to sit there? Am I going to say, no, this is not okay? Maybe some of that, the people that just sat there, will another time say, this is not okay. I can be the one to say so. And also, taking the stand that I did helped me feel right about myself. Helped me like who I was a little better. Mm-hmm. We have responsibilities in the world. The world is an increasingly violent, worrisome place, full of fear and hatred. And nothing I do is going to stop war in the Middle East. Nothing I do is going to bring reason to the House of Representatives. But I can still do one thing to make my corner of the world a better place. Mm-hmm. And I can believe in it, and I can take hope from it. And that will help move me to the next moment.
Mm-hmm. When you were reading other books and you were thinking about writing yours, were there memoirs about companion animals that helped inspire you or spur you on or helped give you a sort of confirmation that this book could do great and was worth writing?
Well, I take inspiration from all over the place. And sometimes I find it in poetry. I love Christopher Smart's famous poem about his cat, Jeffrey, written in the 18th century, in which he pays devotional attention to every little daily gesture that his cat makes, the cat licking his paws, the cat defleeing himself. And this is luminous. It is an act of deep looking, which to me is the essence of writing. And Christopher Smart helped me look deeply at my dog, Casey. Mm-hmm. The memoir that was probably most inspiring during this time was Travels with Charlie by John Steinbeck. Mm-hmm. I did not read Travels with Charlie when it came out because I thought it was about a dog, and I didn't think I was interested in dogs. It is not actually about a dog as such. It is about an aging curmudgeon and a drunk, by the way, going out in search of America. And Charlie is an elderly French poodle who mediates between Steinbeck and the world. Charlie is quietly taking care of Steinbeck. If not for Charlie, Steinbeck would not have the conversations that he does. He would not feel centered in the world, even to the extent that he does. And you can tell that he is a rootless man. Mm-hmm. Charlie inspires a deep tenderness in Steinbeck, and he is the only living creature in that book who does. Steinbeck observes Charlie with such love. There's a wonderful section in which Charlie stands up to a bear, and in which Steinbeck observes, the difficulty that Charlie is having peeing. And you can tell that Charlie is not a very well dog. He did, in fact, die not too long after Steinbeck finished the book. I recommend this book to anyone who wants to write about animals with freshness and without anthropomorphizing and without sentimentality.
Thank you for that. Do you want to read that excerpt we talked about and set it up if you feel like it needs a little bit of that?
Absolutely. This passage is about my desire from the beginning that Casey should be friends with our grandson. And I came to realize that this was just not happening. So here goes. I'd always thought kids and dogs were like Lassie and Timmy, meant to be together. In fact, there are dogs who feel anxious around small, impulsive humans and Casey is that kind of dog. Some kids approached him politely and asked, "May I pet him?" Their parents had warned them that a frightened dog may bite. Casey hardly distinguished between well-schooled children and the ones who pointed and hopped like wind-up toys. Either way, he growled and stiffened. We came up with a story for the crestfallen children, one that sounded vaguely true. "Sorry, he's scared of kids. He used to live in a prison, and he never saw kids there." "Bet you never guessed a kid like you could be scary." The children's eyes grew wide. They craved more details about Casey's life behind bars, but it only took a minute to recount what little we knew. The child who scared Casey most was our 6-year-old grandson, who'd been asking for a dog of his own and hoped ours would be an affectionate stand-in. Things went badly from the start. Casey resented this dog-sized creature with the nerve to displace him on the sofa cushion next to the font of all goodness, Grandpa to Cameron. Finding Paul and Cameron side by side, Casey would launch himself at them in a frenzy of licking and wagging, as if to say, "Mine! Mine!" Cameron's response to this never varied. "Casey's going to bite me." Not a day passed when one of us did not exclaim, "Casey, you're a complication," always spoken with a little irritation and a lot of gratitude for how bearable the complications were. It became a one-line love song, treasured because no one but ourselves could sing it, and with every repetition we celebrated love itself. No complications, no Casey. "I'm not one for regrets," Paul said, "but sometimes I think of all the other dogs we could have loved before Casey." "Being our first is part of Casey's specialness. He's our starter dog, the one who shows us what living with a dog is all about." I caught myself. At our age, we wouldn't have a dynasty of dogs to love. Maybe one more if we were lucky. But another dog could only mean the loss of Casey. How could we call that luck? A friend's warning came back to me. "Remember, this will be a 10-year commitment." 10 years, the difference between ankle socks and nylons, fighting with my mother and becoming a mother, moving into the big corner office and handing in my key. I was hoping for more than 10 years with Casey, which would bring us close to 80, if not all the way there. He might be our first and last.
Thank you. You know, I was thinking about this dog and how you imbue your story with his energy and the personality there and how he disrupts and then, of course, almost rebuilds your small family. And I was wondering, what took you by surprise personally as you drafted and revised this manuscript?
There were many surprises, and the greatest, I would say, is how little I actually knew about where I was going. I had to learn to be guided by feeling. It really all comes back to that. And as I worked, I saw a pattern in the feeling that the story I was telling was not really about the dog. It was about an opening up in me. I got very lost in the writing of the book because I didn't know what the end would be. And my husband and I used to joke, well, we're calling it Starter Dog, but it's got to end somewhere. And if I keep dragging my feet about getting to the end, well, Casey isn't even going to be alive at the end of the book, and I certainly wanted him to be alive at the launch. I had to put it aside for a while. I had to put it aside, actually, for quite a long time, a number of months. And then COVID happened, And while COVID was going on, there were two big developments. A character in the book who had been close to my heart and Casey's died. And my husband and I celebrated our 50th anniversary in lockdown, all dressed up. And I went back to the beginning of the book, to the very first chapter, and I saw that the conflict in the book, the story I was going to tell, was all about how would I resolve this sense of unfinished business, this feeling that I would die an unrealized person. I thought I needed a project, but no, I needed a birth, a rebirth of Rona. I needed a second chance. And that is all prefigured in the very first chapter. I could finally see that after having put the book aside and after having lived the ending to the book. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that. I really feel like you're taking me through the process of writing it and how you were stumped for just a while and then going back. And the nature of writing a memoir is really encapsulated by what you said. You mentioned that the Steinbeck book was really helpful to you in writing this book. Are there other memoirs or craft books at all that you would like to recommend to writers working on their memoirs?
I'm a huge fan of What Comes Next and How to Like It by Abigail Thomas. I love Truth and Beauty by Ann Patchett. Mm-hmm. And I particularly like to recommend books that hardly anyone has heard of. One of these is In the Key of New York by the wonderful Rebecca McClanahan. It is, like my book, a very short book about a woman later in life starting afresh, in her case, by moving to New York City.
Thank you. I'll put those in the show notes. And is there any last piece of advice you'd like to share for writers working on their memoirs?
Well, this may seem counterintuitive, but see if you can come up with a subtitle and a title. The title really kept me grounded, Starter Dog, because it encapsulated how Casey was not only the first dog, but he was also the start of many things, of a revitalized marriage and a purpose in life and a second chance. Writers often leave the title till last. I've seen many, many writers do this, but if you can possibly think about the title early, it just might be the key to the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what's funny is that I think until you said it just now, I didn't really understand the nuance in Starter Dog.
Well, neither did I until the book was in my hands. I thought, oh, yeah, it's about all the things that he started. And I did the subtitle toward the end of the writing, My Path to Joy, Belonging, and Loving This World. And it was my husband who saw that the book would have three sections, and one would be called Joy, one would be Belonging, and one would be Loving This World. How cool is that?
Yes, and it also reminds me that often we are smarter even than we think. Our writing selves, this sort of consciousness that's there, or subconsciousness, that we're working on something. There's something we're chomping on, right, or chewing on. And we think we know all of it, but really underneath that, there's something else that maybe the smarter version of us or the sixth sense writer of us already knows, which is kind of what was at play.
Absolutely. And my last tip is carry a camera phone. Take lots of pictures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. Thank you so much. Where can people find you, Rona? Where can they get your book and learn more about you?
They can get my book on Amazon or really wherever they buy their books, including their favorite indie bookstore. They can find me at my new Substack, Amazement Seeker, or on Facebook. I am very active there.
Great.
Plus all the usual. Oh, RonaMaynard.com. Let's not forget my website.
I know, right? That's the most important one, practice.
Yes, and there are lots of photos there of dog walks.
Okay, great. So I'll have your book recommendations and I will have your links so people can find you right there in the show notes. And I want to thank you for being my guest and for sharing your writing process and your story today.
Thank you so much, Renee.
Thank you for tuning in to Let's Talk Memoir. For more about this episode and my guest, please visit the link in the show notes or on Instagram at Ronit Plank. That's RonitPlank. You can also follow me on Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok. If you liked this episode of Let's Talk Memoir, please go ahead and share it with your friends and subscribe. And if you have 2 more seconds, you can rate and review it on Apple Podcasts, which really does help other people find the show. Thank you so much for being here.